What does it feel like to be removed from your parents' home, from the ones who were supposed to protect you and keep you safe?
It kind of makes you feel disposable, and that's not a good feeling at all.
The purpose of the child welfare system is to keep kids safe from harm. When a mom or dad can't do that, a child is removed and placed in foster care, in a home that's not one's own.
Think of what you would feel like if you were someone picked you up and dropped you in the middle of China and said, "This is your normal now." It's not normal.
I'm Jennifer Guerra. Over the next hour, we'll look at the lives of youth in foster care and what happens when they age out.
It was pretty scary, to be honest. Every 18 and 19-year-old thinks they're ready. Everybody does. But you're not. No.
That's all coming up on our special State of Opportunity documentary, Finding Home, on Michigan Radio. But first, the news. I want to introduce you to a set of siblings. Let's start with the oldest one, Andrew. He is an intense little guy who's 9 years old and very much into superheroes.
My favorite Marvel superhero is Spider-Man.
I want to see my best friend.
Hello, I'm Princess Bunny.
That's Audrey, his little sister. She is
5
and adorably shy. And finally, there's Brayden, the ham of the family.
Let it go. Can't hold it back yet.
Brayden, or Brady, as his sister calls him, is 4 years old and the youngest of the three siblings. They have a mom and a dad now, but for a little while there, they didn't. The state had to step in and, in effect, become their parent after this happened.
My old dad punched my old mom in the eye.
Yeah, and then my dad had to go to jail.
Prison.
Jail or prison?
Prison.
When Audrey and her brothers were removed from their biological parents' home, they became wards of the state. Andrew was 7, Audrey was 3, and Brady was 2. It's a fate more than 13,000 children in Michigan face every year, nearly 400,000 across the country. Overall, the outcomes for these kids in care, not great. They grapple with mental health issues, behavioral issues, academic issues, to name a few. Over the next hour, we'll hear what life is like for Audrey, Brady, and Andrew, and other youth who have been in foster care, and what's being done to help improve their futures. I'm Jennifer Guerra. You're listening to Finding Home, a special State of Opportunity documentary about foster care. I first met Andrew, Audrey, and Brady over the summer. The three siblings were in foster care when they came to live with Sue and Michael Cly. The Clys eventually adopted the kiddos, and they agreed to let me follow their family for a couple of months. The Clys live in the country, in a big house off a dirt road in Howell, Michigan, about an hour from Detroit. There's a giant trampoline out front, a creek in the back. It seems like a pretty ideal place for a kid to grow up. First thing you do when you walk into the Cly house is take off your shoes. It's one of the unwritten rules of the house. The real rules are written in magic marker on a poster-sized piece of paper that hangs in the kitchen right next to the dinner table. Each rule gets its own color.
Brady, do you know what the rules are in your house?
What's the most important rule of the house?
No pequeño boogers.
You can pick your boogers anytime you want to. I don't have a problem with that. What are we not allowed to do?
Are we allowed to hurt people?
No.
No. Are we allowed to hit people?
No.
No, that's bad. We don't hit people, do we?
Yeah, but Quincy just licked me.
Quincy licked you.
Also on the list of Cly family rules, no cursing, no throwing things. If somebody needs space, you have to give them space. And at all times, you have to respect people's boundaries.
I had an 8-year-old say to me, "You have way too many rules at this house." And I'm like, "Yep, buddy, that's why you're here, because we actually have rules. And there are things that you have to do or not do," because he ran the roost. He did whatever he wanted to.
The Clys didn't just pluck these rules out of the sky. They developed them over many years of parenting. Sue Cly says being a mom was what she was meant to do.
I have been a mother from probably the day I was born. I remember being 5 years old. When I grew up, I wasn't going to college. I was going to be a mom.
And she does have this Earth Mother quality about her. The first day we met, she had on a long tie-dye dress. When she's not holding a giant cup of coffee in her hand, she's bending down to scoop up a kid in her arms and give them a hug. The Clys have two biological kids, Samantha and Josh. But when they went off to college, Sue Cly was just 42 years old, and she was not ready to be an empty nester.
And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have any kids. What am I going to do? And as I was literally sitting at the kitchen table crying because they were both going to be gone, I opened up to the editorial page and it said, Livingston County is short of foster homes. And I went, oh, bingo, it's a twofer. I get to be a mom and they get a foster home. So that's actually how we became foster parents.
Go.
That was a decade ago. For the first 7 years as foster parents, the Clys took in what many consider the toughest group of kids to foster, teenage boys. For a long time, Sue and Michael Cly were one of the only, if not the only, foster home for teen boys in Livingston County.
It's very hard work. It's the hardest job I've ever had. There's no doubt about it.
And I could tell stories that most people wouldn't want to hear because I've always said ignorance is bliss. Most people don't know what happens to these kids. And their stories are really hard. They're really hard.
They've seen just about everything. They've taken in kids who have been repeatedly abused, sexually, physically, emotionally. Many of the kids they fostered have suffered from extreme neglect. The stories they could tell you are truly heinous. Some teens stayed a few months, some longer. They actually don't even know how many teens they fostered over those 7 years. They stopped counting. Michael Cly guesses it was somewhere between 30 and 50. Sue Cly says she told each and every teen who came to live with them the same two things. One, you are loved. And two, this isn't your fault. Still, the transition is never easy.
Think of what you would feel like if someone picked you up and dropped you in the middle of China and said, this is your normal now. It's not normal. The way you live is different than the way they live. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in your home. So they don't come in and say, oh, you have a nice house. I like it here. Thank you for feeding me. Life is grand now. It's not how kids feel coming into care.
The Clys were good at what they did. But after a while, it took a toll on them and they needed a change. So instead of teens, they took in little ones. That's when they met Brady, Andrew, and Audrey, and eventually adopted them. I asked the trio what's the best part about living here.
We get to sit around the campfire.
Get to sit around. We go camping.
And we get to roast marshmallows.
We get to roast marshmallows. Audrey, can you use one word to say what it's like to live here? What do we have around the house here?
A force field.
A force field. Why do we have a force field?
So no bad guys can get in.
So it's what here?
Safe.
It's safe here, isn't it?
No monsters.
No monsters.
Safety. It's a huge thing for Audrey and her brothers and for foster kids in general. The entire purpose of the child welfare system is to keep kids safe from harm. When a mom or dad can't do that, the child is removed and placed in foster care. Given that context, the big piece of poster paper with the Cly family rules on it, it makes sense. It's a visual reminder to any foster kid who walks in the door that this is a safe place.
Hey guys, dinner!
Before we get to dinner, let's talk a little bit more about foster care. Now, if the state determines that a child's home is not safe, the child is put in foster care. The goal of foster care is to reunite a child with his parents. If that can't happen, if after, say, a year or so, the parents can't get their act together enough to ensure the child's safety, then the parents' rights are terminated. In that case, the child stays in foster care until some kind of other permanent plan is found, like adoption. That's what happened with Andrew, Audrey, and Brady.
Hey, guys, dinner.
Okay, now back to dinner. Sue Cly works as a teaching assistant at a school for kids with disabilities. Michael Cly is an out-of-work carpenter, so he's taken on the role of stay-at-home dad, picking up the kids from school, cleaning the house, making dinner. Tonight's meal?
Chicken. It's Italian chicken. It's just marinated overnight in Italian dressing. And, it's always juicy, and they all seem to like it. I don't know about the noodles. I'm sure somebody will argue about that.
Like a lot of families, dinner is a constant negotiation. There are 5 kids in the Cly household, the 3 adopted siblings and 2 sisters from foster care. Italian chicken is one of only 2 meals every kid in the house likes. The other is tacos. Still, listening to kids whine about what's for dinner seems minor in comparison to the other stuff the Clys deal with every day. Take Audrey, for example. She was just over 2 years old when she was removed from her birth home because of domestic violence. She's fuzzy on the details of how it all went down, but she still thinks about it a lot. Sue Cly has to constantly reassure Audrey that she's loved and that she gets to stay with them forever and ever and ever.
We like to use the word forever.
But when
that's what we try to be, huh?
Yeah, but when I lived with Samantha.
Samantha is Audrey's birth mom.
I thought I could live with her forever.
And that didn't happen, didn't it?
No.
So now you're worried it might happen again?
Yeah.
But it's not gonna, because we're gonna keep you forever.
Yeah, because I already got adopted here.
And just like that, she hops off her mom's lap, puts on her Mickey Mouse princess hat, and goes back to building a fort. It's a scene that'll be repeated, if not that day, later in the week. Audrey often needs to be reassured that she won't be taken away. Nearby, her older brother, Andrew, plays on a tablet. He's got on a Captain America t-shirt. He tells me it's his favorite Avenger. Andrew used to try to protect his little brother and sister whenever their parents would fight. So it makes sense that he loves superheroes so much. In a very real way, he is one. Like the vast majority of kids in care, Andrew and his siblings bounced around from foster home to foster home before they were adopted. Several former foster youth told me they used to carry their stuff around from house to house in a plastic garbage bag. Along the way, you lose things.
I left my paper jam.
That's a toy guitar.
And the sound box that makes it even louder. At my Uncle Steven's, and Audrey lost her pink bunny and from...
No, it was a frog.
No, it was a pink bunny and
no.
from Mama Samantha, and Brady got
a turtle.
No, it was a duck.
Oh, yeah.
It was from Mama Samantha, and I got a blue bunny, which is still here.
Andrew carries around the trauma of his early home life much more visibly than the other two, perhaps because he's the oldest, perhaps because he witnessed the most abuse in the home. He's on medication. He's been in therapy, out of therapy, and back again. His adoptive mom, Sue Cly, says he's better than he was when he first moved in 2 years ago. Back then, she says, things were really bad.
He was, for lack of a better term, he was a mess when he came to us. He cried constantly. He was very angry. He was very aggressive. He would have 3 to 4 meltdowns a day at 45 minutes at a time. He was terrified. If you heard the dog bark, he would go underneath the table and he would stay there until he could calm himself down. He is functional and he is okay. I shouldn't say he's okay. He's functional and he is, but he still has a lot of issues and a lot of triggers. And as he's growing, we're seeing those things come back that seem to be better at one point.
The littlest one, Brady, was just 14 months old when he was removed from his birth parents, but the trauma still sticks with him.
When he was a baby, he used to slap us all in the face. Okay, I'm going to do a slow motion how you did it to me.
No.
Did you catch that? Brady, the one with the adorable toothy grin and the bowl-cut hairstyle, he used to slap his sister Audrey in the face. She says it didn't hurt, but Sue Cly remembers it differently.
He smacked his sister in the face. She was crying, and I said, "What happened? Brady hit me." I said, "Why did you hit her?" He said, "'Cause she wouldn't shut up when I told her to." And it's one of those, you know, is this organic? Is this something that nurture or nature? Is this, he was 14 months when he was taken away. So how do you remember something that young? And it's not something that he would have heard anywhere else since that time that he had left. So it's a very interesting place to be. I wouldn't want to do anything else. And I love my babies too, all of them. very much. But it's a different life. It's a different life to me.
It's hard to underestimate just how much trauma can mess us up. And the earlier it happens, the more damage it can do. There's been an explosion of research over the past decade that shows how important the first few years of a child's life are in terms of brain development. In order to have healthy brain development, kids need to grow up in a stable, nurturing home. When that doesn't happen, our bodies and brains go into overdrive, and the effects can be devastating. How devastating?
The relationship between early adversity and lifetime health is really just a major public health threat.
We'll talk about trauma and how it can throw a child's system out of whack. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity special about foster care on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Let's return to the Cly household in Howell. On this particular morning, before I can even make my way up the driveway, there's Sue Cly walking towards me with her trademark travel-sized coffee mug.
Oh, girlfriend, you hit the jackpot today.
The jackpot, it turns out, is a young man named Jerry.
I was Susie's favorite kid, but I was the worst.
He's the one that broke me.
You mean broke you as a foster parent?
As in taking care of teen boys, yeah. All we took care of was teen boys, and Jerry was the last one. After Jerry, I said, nope, can't do this no more. We're going to have to change our ways. Taking little ones.
What did you do that broke her?
What didn't I do? It was something new every time.
Jerry Castor is 22 years old, and he's one of the Clys' forever kids. That's the name the Clys use for their former foster kids who aged out of the system. Sue Cly wasn't planning to see Jerry today, but then she got a call at 5 in the morning from the Ingham County Jail. Jerry was getting out of jail, and he needed a ride.
So I got up and made myself some coffee and took off to Ingham County Jail. Not my first time that I've had to pick a kid up from jail, but that's okay. It was for Jerry.
Jerry's been in jail twice before, once for smoking underage and once for stealing. This time he got picked up because he hasn't paid his court fines. And it's not clear he'll ever be able to pay them. He's homeless. He's mentally ill. He doesn't have a job. But for every month he doesn't pay, the fines just keep going up and up. Jerry's situation isn't uncommon. Young people who age out of foster care without a family face some seriously daunting odds. And the numbers bear it out. They're more likely to be homeless, more likely to be incarcerated, more likely to be high school dropouts. Remember, over the 7 years that the Clys were foster parents, Michael Cly says they had about 30 or so teens come to live with them.
And out of them, we had
two graduate
from high school.
Jerry wasn't one of them. Jerry entered care when he was 5 years old, then went back to live with his mom for a time, then was removed again. He was adopted at age 14, but 2 years later it fell through. So he went back into the system and bounced around from foster home to foster home.
Going from home to home is really hard because you really got to learn a lot of personality traits because as you think about it, you start over new school, new friends, new people, new situation, new circumstances. Yeah. It kind of makes you feel disposable. And that's not a good feeling at all.
You said you were homeless now.
Yeah, I'm homeless now.
Why is that?
Bad decisions.
Mental illness.
Yeah.
Jerry finds it very difficult to keep it together for longer than about 3 months at a time. This last run was about 6 months, and that was really, really good for Jerry.
Let me jump in here for a second. Jerry is on medication for his mental illness, and he gets disability insurance from the government. Now, there are plenty of former foster care youth who grow up to be well-adjusted adults. But there are also people, like Jerry, who went through serious trauma and continue to struggle into adulthood. Jerry and his forever mom, Sue Cly, say Jerry's troubles can likely be traced back to his original trauma, the thing that took him away from his birth parents. He was abused. He wouldn't go into detail, except to say this.
I felt like if life was a poker game, I got dealt twos.
There's no doubt that he got dealt one of the worst.
Go.
It is amazing to me that any of our teen children are not drug addicts laying in the gutter somewhere. That you can go through and survive what they've been through and come out the other end and be okay is nothing short of a miracle.
You are listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity special about foster care. You've heard the word trauma now a few times this hour, and a lot of people throw around that word a lot, like, oh, that test was so traumatic, I totally failed it, that kind of thing. Nadine Burke-Harris says that is not the kind of trauma we're talking about here.
Generally, the way I would define trauma in general is really any threat that is so severe that it overwhelms our system, and particularly it tends to undermine feelings of safety. It really tests our coping mechanisms.
Nadine Burke-Harris is a pediatrician at the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco. And she says to better understand how trauma works, close your eyes. Go ahead. Okay. Now imagine you are walking in a forest and all of a sudden you see a bear. Your blood pressure spikes, your heart starts to race, your pupils dilate. Burke-Harris says that's all good. It's a life-saving response. You are ready now to either fight the bear or run. But here's the catch. The fight or flight response, it was designed to be a once in a while type thing.
For kids who are growing up in households where they're experiencing frequent, repeated, or severe adversity, this physical response is activated over and over and over again. And so it goes from being adaptive or life-saving to being maladaptive or health damaging.
In other words, early trauma throws a child's response system out of whack, making them impulsive and unable to regulate their behaviors. There's a landmark study about all of this from the late 90s called the ACE study, A-C-E, Adverse Childhood Experiences. Researchers in California interviewed more than 17,000 adults. For every adverse experience an adult had as a kid, they got a point. Physical abuse, 1 point. Sexual abuse, another point. And on and on. The more points somebody had, the worse their health was.
So for a person who had an ACE score of 4, their risk of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease was 2.5 times that of someone with an ACE score of 0. For depression, it was 4.5 times. For suicidality, it was 12 times. It's pretty profound. Like, when you think about it, the relationship between early adversity and lifetime health is really just a major public health threat.
So what do we do with this information? Well, that's where this guy comes in.
CC, how are
you? I'm doing very well.
All right, good.
Jim Henry worked in the child welfare system for over 15 years. He now works at Western Michigan University, where he runs the Children's Trauma Assessment Center. That's where we are now. The center has one purpose, to assess how kids' brains are affected by trauma. Henry and his team see kids from all over the state, nearly all of them from the foster care system. The child is usually referred to the center because he or she is acting out in some way. Sexualized behaviors, acts of aggression, self-harm. Those behaviors, Henry says, those are just symptoms.
What we're trying to, in our center, is to help people begin to reinterpret symptoms, not as the child is lazy or defective or emotionally disturbed, but the child has been traumatized, and therefore these behaviors are consistent with a child who's experienced an overwhelming event that has taken away his or her sense of safety and continues to see the world as dangerous. That's what we're trying to get people to look at and consider in those behaviors.
So how does it work? Well, if you're picturing a person in a lab coat sitting behind a desk asking a patient a bunch of questions, that is not how this place works. First off, a child doesn't just see one person. He sees a whole group of people, a social worker, occupational therapist, speech and language therapist, a pediatrician, and a nurse. And it's very interactive. I watched them assess a 4-year-old boy, and it looked a lot like play, lots of reading books and playing games on the floor. The whole time, the team is assessing how the child's brain works through language, memory, attention. After several hours, the child leaves, and the team writes up a lengthy report. Here's what we saw, here are some concerns, and here's what we can do to help the child overcome trauma.
We're trying to help them build the skills of regulation. Kids want to be successful. Kids want to have relationships. And so that takes ongoing practice, repetition, reminders.
He teaches children how to calm themselves down, simple breathing techniques, how to identify triggers, things that rev them up, and ways to deal with it. There's lots of research that this kind of trauma-informed treatment works for kids who've been abused and neglected. There's just one problem. There's a year-long waiting list to get in to see Jim Henry. One foster care worker told me over the summer that she can't get her client in until next May. Henry and his team are in the process of training foster care caseworkers across the state, but frankly, it's a big state, and they've got a long way to go. Also, these kinds of in-depth assessments, they're considered the gold standard. They're expensive. DHS just doesn't have that kind of money to work with. So what are we doing when a child comes into the foster care system?
The initial assessment tends to be pretty superficial. That is, it doesn't really look in depth at the child, the parent, and then how they interact together.
Frank Vandervoort is a University of Michigan law professor, and he specializes in child welfare.
The way we run the foster care system, it would be as if you went to your doctor and they took your temperature and your blood pressure and your pulse, and then they immediately put a cast on your right leg. And then they send you away, and then about three months later, you come back, and then they figure out, and they actually take some x-rays, and they figure out that it was your left wrist, not your right ankle, that was broken all the time. And we do that in child welfare as a matter of practice.
He says after the initial assessments, parents have to go through a number of steps to get their kids back. And he says those steps are pretty standardized. Some combination of parenting classes, counseling, and drug treatment if needed. Now, many of the foster care workers I spoke to for this report, they are busting their butts to try and provide the best services they can for their families. But
we know for a long time that some of the services that we provide are not effective, yet we continue to provide those services.
DHS is moving towards more evidence-based practices, using research and data to decide which programs work and which don't. But frankly, it's a slow-moving ship. Michigan's foster care system is the eighth largest in the country. And really, there's only so much DHS can do. Poverty plays a huge role in the child welfare system. And it's not like DHS can come in and wave a magic wand. Poof! Cycle of poverty is broken. Now let's help your kids. That's just not realistic. Now, let's take a minute and talk about the other elephant in the room.
The lawsuit.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jen.
Sarah Alvarez is a reporter with State of Opportunity, and she's been following the lawsuit for a while now. A little explainer. 8 years ago, an advocacy group called Children's Rights sued the state and its Department of Human Services for the way it was treating its foster kids. The list of grievances against the state is long, too long to list here. But Sarah, do you want to give us a couple bullet points?
Sure. Here's a few points. Foster care workers didn't have enough training, and they had more work than they could handle. Kids were languishing in the system for years on end and shuffling around, you know, from home to home. They weren't getting enough health care for physical or mental health needs. And too many foster kids were abused or neglected under the state's watch.
Okay. So after the state was sued in 2006, they were monitored, and they've been continuously monitored since then. Now, if the goal of foster care is to keep kids safe, how are we doing?
Well, we're doing better than we were in 2006, that's for sure. And those court monitors, the ones that keep tabs on the system, they give a lot of credit to DHS Director Maura Corrigan for really cleaning things up. But our state foster care system was such a mess in 2006 that even though we're doing better, it's still not a rosy picture.
Huh.
So, for example, in the last monitoring report, there were over 1,000 kids who were abused or neglected again within 6 months of having contact with the child welfare system. What we're talking about here is the number of children who were abused or neglected in the child welfare system in general, not just in foster care. And the court said that the state needs to make sure at least 95% of the kids in the child welfare system aren't being abused or neglected again within that short period of time. And the state isn't there.
So what do you see as the biggest problem with the child welfare system?
The court monitors have a lot of concerns about the system, but overall, I'd say the number one issue is that the state is still not keeping track of kids well enough to know if they're doing okay. There's just not good information on the well-being of these kids. So all of these things that the state's not tracking, like things like education and medical treatment, those things can be incredibly important in the life of a child and really important to their future success.
To be fair, the state earlier this year rolled out this giant data system. It's basically this big computer system that lets a bunch of different agencies talk to each other and share information about kids in foster care. They spent something like $70 million on this thing. There are a lot of kinks. Lots of workers still need to be trained on how to use it, but the goal is to be able to track all the kids in care more effectively. But you're saying we're not there yet.
We're not, and there's still a lot of data missing from the database.
And I want to be clear here. It doesn't mean that individual caseworkers aren't tracking these things. Hopefully they are. But right now, at the state level, we can't track a lot of it.
That's right.
Okay, so let's go through a quick checklist here.
Let's do it.
Okay. Do we know if kids in care are in school?
We don't.
Do we know if kids have health care?
No.
Do we know the types of medication that kids in foster care are taking?
We don't.
Do we know if they're being separated from their siblings?
No.
Do we know if or how many times they get to visit their siblings?
We don't know that either.
Now, one of the things we are tracking, the number of visits that caseworkers make, how's that going?
Well, that is getting better. Caseworkers, because of this lawsuit, have fewer kids on their caseloads. But during the last monitoring period, kids were still not being visited by their caseworkers as often as the state said they would be.
Okay, thanks, Sarah.
Sure.
Okay, to hear what the state is doing right in terms of foster care, and there are a number of things, let's turn to Maura Corrigan. She runs the Michigan Department of Human Services, which oversees the foster care system.
Is it as good as it could be? No. Is it better than it was? Yes, indeed.
The system is providing good, in some cases, life-saving care for kids. And many say Corrigan has been instrumental in making things better for kids in care. I ask her what she's most excited about when it comes to improvements in the system.
Probably the most exciting thing that I've seen, I call it the equivalent of a cure for cancer, is what we're doing with quote-unquote predictive analytics.
I know. It sounds like a total snooze fest. But stick with me here for a minute because it's actually quite stunning. Parts of Tampa, Florida had real problems with child abuse and neglect. After a series of children's deaths, they decided to do something about it. Basically, they looked at the data and came up with a list of factors that made it more likely a child would be abused or neglected. Factors like the age of the parent, age of the child, if there's a history of mental health or domestic violence in the home. And then here's what they did with that information.
They took those factors and they went then at every live birth in Tampa to determine whether those factors existed in those cases. And they had caseworker interventions where those factors appeared that effectively brought Tampa to zero deaths from abuse and neglect, both inside and outside of the system.
Corrigan was so impressed, she sent a team to Florida to see the work in action. They liked it so much, the state is now piloting a similar program in Ingham County. And it makes sense they'd start there. The county's child abuse and neglect rate went way up from 2005 to 2011. We are talking a 92% spike in confirmed abuse and neglect cases. So in addition to what will hopefully be a very successful pilot program in Ingham County, there are several other improvements Director Corrigan is proud of. The number of adoptions are up, the number of children who remain with their parents is up, and foster care workers' caseloads are significantly down. Coming up, we've talked a lot about what life is like in foster care, but what happens when you age out?
It was pretty scary, to be honest. Every 18 and 19-year-old thinks they're ready. Everybody does. But you're not. No.
Making it on your own as a former foster care youth. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity special about foster care on Michigan Radio. Hi, I'm Jennifer Guerra, and you're listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. If you're just joining us, this hour we've been talking about youth in foster care. Now, at its core, the whole reason for the foster care system is to keep kids safe. Sometimes, actually pretty often, that means removing the child from their parents' home. The child becomes a ward of the state, which means the state, effectively, becomes the child's parent. Before the break, we heard from Michigan Department of Human Services Director Maura Corrigan. I asked her if the state is really set up to be a good parent.
The state can never be a very good parent, can it? That's why we have so much focus on getting children to permanency. What the state is assigned to do by law, it should do as well as it can. And then we should get out of the way and let parents do the job of parenting.
So how do we do that? Well, it turns out reporter Sarah Alvarez knows a guy who has a plan. His name is Jim McCormick, and he figured out how to teach parents from the foster care system how to be better parents. Here's Sarah.
Before we get into too many details, you ought to know a little bit about Jim McCormick. He looks like Santa Claus without the beard. Rosy cheeks, wire-rimmed glasses, a white mustache, you know, jolly. McCormick retired a few months ago from his job in Michigan's child welfare system. He worked there for 38 years, which is phenomenal when you consider the turnover rate for most foster care workers is more like 2 years. And for good reason, working in the child welfare system is stressful. McCormick says he's still recovering from his old job.
I was on a lot of prescription medication. I was not sleeping. I would take too much work home, not physical work, but emotional work. And I tell you the fear that every DHS employee worth their salt has, and that's that a kid dies on your watch. And thank the stars I did not have that happen.
Last year, 16 kids died in Michigan's foster care system, many from abuse or neglect. The number seems to be going down, but it's still too high. McCormick spent most of his career up north as a DHS director for Newaygo and Lake counties. Both counties are super rural and very poor. But the counties had some success stories, programs that helped children and their parents function as a family. I took a ride with McCormick to where one of those programs used to be.
We are going to go about a block south and a block west to our parking lot.
That's right, a parking lot. But back in the early 90s, the parking lot was a building, a house called Smoggin House. Parents who were this close to losing their kids to the system came here to learn the basics of how to be a parent.
We're talking people that didn't even know about having an alarm clock so their kid could get to school on time. I mean, it's those people were very disabled socially.
McCormick leased the house from the county for a little over a year. Every month, a new family moved into the house. But they weren't alone. A DHS staffer also lived with them full time.
And she became their mentor during those 30 days. And she taught them how to cook, worked on employment skills, worked on relationship skills, and generally just helped heal the family.
And it worked. All the families that went through the program at Smoggin House, McCormick says none of their kids wound up in the foster care system, or even had any more contact with the child welfare system.
It was an incredible 13-month run. Unfortunately, as happens in bureaucracies, somebody in Lansing decided they had a better use for the money, and we were no longer able to secure our own federal funding, and the program had to shut down.
McCormick can rattle off even more examples of local programs that worked really well, only to have them defunded or discontinued. McCormick is a parent himself. What he thinks is so central to being a good parent is something he thinks the state can't or won't do for the kids in their care, respond to their kids' ever-changing needs.
You have to be adaptable and flexible in order to parent well, and so shall be the government. If they're going to be the parent, if they're the family, then they've got to be able to adapt as well for each individual child's needs. And we need to find some way to unshackle the bureaucracy and hold people accountable for the outcomes. No question about that. But we've got to let local innovations rise.
You're listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. We've spent a lot of this hour talking about what life is like for youth in foster care. But there's an expiration date on foster care. In most cases, you age out when you're 18. Think about that. 18 years old, totally, completely on your own. Michigan is one of the few states that gives you the option to stay in foster care until you're 21, which can be helpful for a lot of youth. Jasmine Ukda wasn't so lucky. She aged out of Michigan's foster care system 5 years ago, before Michigan extended its age limit for foster care. Ukda was just 19 years old when she was thrown into the real world.
It was pretty scary, to be honest. Every 18 and 19-year-old thinks they're ready. Everybody does. But you're not. No, you're not. You're not ready for shut-off notices. You're not ready for eviction notices. You're not ready for car repossessions.
Well, let me ask you a couple. Let's do a little checklist here. So when you were when you aged out at 19, did you have a job?
When I first aged out, no.
Did you have a checking account?
No.
So I'm guessing you didn't have a savings account either?
No.
Did you have a car?
No. I didn't even know how to properly fill my refrigerator, honestly.
Like, what did you think went in your refrigerator?
I bought a bunch of snacks and junk that I never could really have as a child. Like, I bought everything that was horrible for me, so.
You didn't have your mom saying, more broccoli, put more broccoli in there, and put apples and milk and orange juice.
No, I didn't. I had like 10 boxes of cereal and 1 gallon of milk and some Hot Pockets.
Jasmine Ukda can laugh about it now, but back then, she says she was really upset about how the whole thing went down when she aged out. The state had set her up with some transitional housing, but it fell through after a few months. She had nowhere to go. So she went to the only place she knew, her mom's house, a place Child Protective Services had removed her from twice.
The system does set you up, not for failure, but it sets you up to be a statistic, either to be in jail or to do some type of criminal activity or to go back to where you came from. So I feel like the system set me up to go back to my biological mother, the person that the state felt like you never should have been with in the first place.
Ukda was placed in foster care when she was 7 years old. She went back to live with her mom when she was 12, but wound up back in foster care by the time she was 16 and stayed there until she aged out. During that time, she says she went to 15 different schools and lived in 24 different foster homes. The older she got, the more time she had to move.
A lot of people did not want to deal with teenagers. So I was put in something called temporary placements. So I would be put into a temporary placement just about every week of my life because these parents didn't want a teenager. They preferred children.
You mean, so you would stay there, and then if they said, oh, we have a two-year-old who needs a place, they would kind of get you out of there and take the two-year-old.
Exactly. It made me feel like no one actually wanted me, to be honest.
Jasmine Ukda has had more bad things happen to her than many of us will experience in our lifetimes. But Ukda, at 24 years old, is the very definition of tenacious. And she says overall, being in the foster care system was good for her. It doesn't hurt, she says, that the state will help her pay for college. Let me explain. Michigan is now one of the better states when it comes to aging out of foster care. Not only are youth allowed to stay in care longer, Michigan, in conjunction with its colleges and universities, is able to offer what is essentially a full ride to college for youth who have aged out of the system. When Ukda found out about the state's Fostering Future scholarship, she applied. She did not get it.
But it took a lot of determination, and I think a lot of my determination came from me being in a system where I don't take no as an answer. And so I called the main CEO, and I asked, why did you guys deny me? And she was like, well, you didn't turn in your financial aid award letter. And I'm like, well, I didn't get one. So here's information proving I didn't, and I finally got my scholarship. So I'm thankful for that.
She's 2 months away from finishing up her associate's degree, and then she's off to the University of Michigan in Flint to get her bachelor's in social work. Nationwide, 97% of former foster youth do not graduate college. Ukta is determined to graduate, and she has big plans.
I would like to develop my own nonprofit organization. My goal is to buy a lot of houses in Detroit and have them available for aged-out foster youth, because I'm realizing that homelessness is a really, really, really bad thing that's going on now. And it's a lot of young people, they are stooping down to levels where they have to sell their bodies, sell drugs, do illegal activities just to survive. And it's like, if I could just help out with just a little bit of those barriers so that they don't become the statistics that they think that foster youth are, then I know that I've accomplished something.
Only those like Jasmine Ukta, who've gone through foster care, can really know what that experience is like. So I asked a bunch of young men and women who have aged out of the system to give us a call and share their thoughts. They called in from all over the state, most of them from college, to answer these two questions. What advice would you give current youth in foster care? And what, if anything, would you change about the system?
Hello, Michigan Radio. My name is Marie Fleming. I'm of Grosse Pointe, Michigan. I entered into foster care when I was 15 years old, and I aged out at 21 years old.
Yes, hi, my name is Alex.
My name is Lily. I am from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
My advice would be to never give up and to always have faith.
My name is Devin Jones, and I was in foster care for about 7 years.
My biggest advice to current foster care youth would be
they need to age out with a job, being in school, and have a stable place to stay.
Okay. Hey, this is Orlando Brown. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, and I went into foster care in December 2000. I was 8 years old. Being in care kind of opened up more doors and opportunities for me because it kind of took me out of the inner city. I got to see another part of life, which kind of helped me stay motivated to go to college. Where I'm from, a lot of people didn't really finish high school, so.
My name is Sheila Van Wert. I'm 23 years old. I entered care right before I was 12 years old.
If I were to change anything as far as the foster care system, I would change the aging out process.
Good things can happen.
Just making sure, like, the foster parent is going to treat them like their own kid, like they're not going to, like, play, like, second best or, like, downgrade the kid if they got their own kid still living in the house.
Focus in school because you have to prove to those who doubted you that you couldn't make it, that you couldn't get a high school diploma, that you couldn't get a college degree. Like, prove them wrong for sure.
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I was in foster care for 4 years. I personally think it's good, except caseworkers change a lot, and it's kind of unsteady.
It's not every kid's dream to go into foster care, but, you know, it's not your fault that the kids went through what they went through, you know. You can't help your parents' choices. So, yeah, just remember, guys, never give up, and good luck to you guys. Bye.
Before we close out the hour, let's check in one last time with Sue Cly, the woman who adopted three siblings from foster care, Andrew, Audrey, and Brady. All three children witnessed domestic violence in their birth home before they were adopted, and they've been in and out of therapy to work through the trauma.
Hello.
Hey, Sue, it's Jennifer. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah? So, I wanted to check in with you since the kids have been in school for, I guess, now a month, right?
Yep.
How's it going?
How's it going? Our lives are falling apart at the seams, actually. It's quite an interesting, I shouldn't say interesting.
Sue Cly tells me that her oldest son, Andrew, is having some real problems in school. He's back in therapy, and they changed up his medicine, which seems to be working a little bit better now.
He's had two good days at school, now maybe three. But prior to that, we were suspended 3 out of the last 6 days for striking our teacher. And
so you're saying Andrew hit his teacher?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Andrew hit his teacher or attempted to hit his teacher, and so he was suspended for a day for each time. Hmm. And so now he's on a stronger medication to help control his behaviors. It's a mood stabilizer. And so he has actually had 3 good days.
Brady, the youngest one, got bumped back to pre-kindergarten or beginner garden. Sue Kly says intellectually he was ready for kindergarten, but emotionally he just wasn't there. As for Audrey, his older sister, she's back to thinking that Sue and Michael Kly don't love her anymore, and she thinks they want to get rid of her.
You know, I wanted to make sure we just reassure her that, no, that's never going to happen. She's going to stay with us forever. And so it's an uphill battle, but we'll keep working on it. We'll keep working on it.
And that's really all they can do. Keep reminding Audrey that she and her siblings are the Kly family's forever kids, that no one's coming to take them away, that they are kids worth loving and keeping. You've been listening to Finding Home, a State of Opportunity special on foster care on Michigan Radio. Today's show was written and produced by me, with additional reporting by Sarah Alvarez. Thanks to Zach Rosen and Brittany Barkoviak for production help. Sarah Hewlett edited today's show. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.